Blog Talk Radio. Listening to the Global Product Management Talk, a regular broadcast for passionate product professionals and business people that don't get a chance to leave their desk and participate in product talks in person, so we bring product talks to you wherever you are. Every episode, we discuss different aspects of what it takes to produce successful products. Everyone is invited, including agile practitioners, user experience designers, content and community managers, business owners, CEOs, entrepreneurs, social media strategists, innovation managers, business analysts, project managers, product managers, program managers, product marketing managers, brand managers, software developers, and you, as well as everyone involved with the entire product lifecycle process from inception to sunsetting. Follow us on Blog Talk Radio. Go to www.blogtalkradio.com/prodmgmttalk. That's our website, www.prodmgmttalk.com. Follow us on Twitter at prodmgmttalk. And use the hashtag to tweet answers to the questions and follow the tweets, # PRODMGMTTALK. Thank you to our platinum sponsor, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management. Visit them on the web, www.aipmm.com. The AIPMM is a worldwide certifying body of product marketing, management, and team professionals. The AIPMM promotes worldwide excellence and forwards product management professionalism with certification credentials, education, trainings, networking, and professional growth opportunities. AIPMM membership benefits include eligibility for certification, partner offerings and training discounts, productivity tools, career center, mentor matching, advanced access to new curriculums, webinar series, thought leaders, and private events. AIPMM certification credentials allow individual members to demonstrate their level of expertise and provide corporate members an assurance that their product professionals are operating at peak performance. Subscribe to the AIPMM Product Management News and Views newsletter, www.aipmm.com/subscribe. Follow at AIPMM on Twitter. Thank you to our broadcast sponsor, Atlassian. Software is transforming the world. Atlassian is helping transform the teams building it. Atlassian helps innovators everywhere plan, build, and launch great software. Find out why more than 21,000 companies of all sizes use Atlassian issue tracking, collaboration, and software development products to work faster and smarter together. Visit Atlassian.com, Atlassian.com. Join us in person for lively discussions and great networking with product professionals at Startup Product Talks San Francisco Monthly. Go to sfproducttalks.com to find out more. Discover how to work together to develop amazing products. Startup Product Summit, February 7th, 2013. Startupproduct.com. This is Cindy F. Solomon, your host for the Global Product Management Talk, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Follow me on Twitter at Cindy F. Solomon and on the web, CindyFSolomon.com. Okay, this is Cindy F. Solomon live. Thanks for joining us today in November. It's November 19th. And I'm delighted to be talking today about the value innovation process with Dick Lee, who is an innovation guru. Most companies today use some form of a phase gate or toll gate process to manage commercialization of their new services or products. These processes are typically over-engineered and lead primarily to incremental improvements. Recently, Christensen and others have asserted that phase gate processes sabotage innovation. The value innovation process breathes the fresh air that fresh gate and toll gate processes need and will minimize the garbage in, garbage out phenomenon many companies are experiencing. I met Dick Lee and our co-host today, Chad McAllister, over the weekend, last weekend in Denver at Rocky Mountain Product Camp, which is a day-long unconference for people to discuss product management, product marketing, and innovation issues. Let me tell you a little bit about Dick. He's the founder of Value Innovations and the co-author of the book Value Innovation Works. He is president and CEO of Value Innovations, Inc., a past member of the BOD, and three-time past chairman of the Emeriti Committee of the Industrial Research Institute. He's been the VP and general manager of two divisions of Fortune 500 companies, the VP of R&D at PharmaSeal, which is a manufacturing arm of American Hospital Supply, and the VP of Strategic Business Operations at Johns Manville. He received his PhD in inorganic chemistry from the University of London. And our co-host, about the book Value Innovation Works, it's a pragmatic, repeatable guide to uncovering your blue ocean opportunities using the 10-step value innovation process. Enabling tools for each of the 10 steps are explained in detail, and examples are provided throughout. At the end of each chapter, there are helpful next steps and takeaway sections. ValueInnovations.com/book/order. Chad, welcome as our co-host. I'm going to have you introduce yourself.
Thank you. Glad to. Chad McAllister, residing in Monument, Colorado, have been involved in product development of primarily software products for over 20 years, leading several different initiatives, and been certified by PDMA as a new product development professional, as well as by AIPMM as a certified innovation leader, and delighted to be co-hosting and have the great opportunity to talk with Dick today, who is a wealth of information when it comes to the topic of value innovation.
Okay, Dick. We're getting to you. I just want to give a shout-out to our tweeters, Larry McKeo, also from Rocky Mountain Product Camp, and a great fan and supporter of the show. Hi, Larry. Thanks for tweeting. We have posted questions out to replies. So let me turn it over to you, Dick. Is there anything I missed in the introduction?
I think you covered the waterfront, Cindy, except there was a new exciting event that happened to me. The day before I met you, I went to an event in the Colorado School of Mines here in Colorado to a meeting of the Fulbright Academy. I had never heard of the Fulbright Academy, but I'm glad I went. I was a Fulbright scholar from 1964 to 66. I found out that there have been over 300,000 Fulbrighters since the program was put into place in 1946 by Senator Fulbright. And so I've now joined the Fulbright Academy, and I'm going to become the co-chair of the Fulbright Academy Entrepreneurs Group. I'm very excited about that.
Excellent. Oh, that reminds me, for people who are participating on Twitter, you can win Dick's book. So we will have a drawing at the end of the hour for the top tweeters to win a free copy of the book, Value Innovation Works. So be sure to tweet using the hashtag pound, #PRODMGMTTALK. So the first question that I had posted, and by the way, tweeters, our format is we post the questions Q1, Q2, Q3. Please answer using A1, A2, A3 so we know which question you're answering. And I will certainly interject your answers. And we always ask you to introduce yourself, where you're tweeting from, and your involvement with product management and or innovation. So the first question that we tweeted out was, exactly what is innovation?
And do you want me to respond to that question, Cindy, or are we going to be waiting for responses here?
So I'll read one of the answers that got tweeted out there on the Twittersphere. Innovation is creating new value to meet new needs, unarticulated needs or old needs in new ways, because there's always a better way to do something. So,
that sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah. So what is your definition of innovation?
Well, let me first put a proviso out there, Cindy, and it's this, that there are at least 14 schools of thought today on innovation. Customer-centric, disruptive, open, strategic, management, you name it, there are 14 of them. One of them is value innovation, and that term was coined in the middle 90s by W. Chan Kim and Rene Morvan, who literally wrote the award-winning book Blue Ocean Strategy. And value innovation is the methodology that's the underpinning of that book. But at Value Innovations, we use the term value innovation, not just innovation, and we define value innovation as delivering exceptional value to the most important customer in the value chain all the time, every time. So it requires that you understand your value chain, and the value chain is all the steps between you, your company, and the ultimate end user of whatever product or service it is that you're selling out there. And it's very important to identify that most important customer, especially for companies operating in the world of B2B, and most software companies are, in fact, doing that. And you can take this to the bank, that your most important customer is probably not your direct customer. So it's very important to identify the most important customer, because if you don't, you won't be delivering exceptional value to them.
Okay, you have said a lot. So let's go back into these 14 schools of thought about innovation. Where do people learn about these?
Well, they have to go literally to look at the books that are being written by these people. But if we, for example, take disruptive innovation, the guru on disruptive innovation is Clayton Christensen, and you cited Clay Christensen earlier and his statement about the stage gate process and how it doesn't work too well. I'm sure Bob Cooper, if he was on the show with us now, would push back on that fairly heavily. I would argue that stage gate is not an innovation process. I would argue that stage gate is a process that will move you from the idea that you have to the commercialized version of that. I don't see innovation being a part of the stage gate process at all. It's merely a disciplined approach to get you from the beginning to the end. So Clay Christensen is the author of Disruptive Innovation, Open Innovation. The guru there is Henry Chesbrough, who is at the University of California, Berkeley, just across the bay from you, Cindy. But literally each one of these guys, and for the most part, unfortunately, these gurus are academics, they're professors. And what I don't like about that is they're very bright folks, but they haven't worked a day in industry in their lives, and yet they are the people who bring the tablets down from heaven and share with us this is what innovation is. My question is, how do they know?
Hey, so you make... Go ahead, Chad.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So you came through to value innovation, and I love the emphasis of the word value in the term, through experience and not just the academic route. And so I was curious how, you know, of those 14 methods, and I think you do a pretty good job of kind of summarizing that history in the first part of your book, I recall reading that, but how did you land on value innovation as being distinct from the other 13 and the one that you see bringing the most aid to those involved in innovation efforts?
Great question, Chad. It really goes back to 1997, 1998. I was a very active member of the Industrial Research Institute at that time, and they have a group within the Institute called Research on Research. It's teams that come together and focus on some aspect of the management of R&D and technology. And there was a group vice president at SAIC and I who were reading papers that were being written by Gary Hamel, W. Chan Kim, Renee Morbon, Constantinos Marketes. They're all linked, by the way, through C.K. Prahalad, who unfortunately died a couple of years ago, and he was the dean of the business school in Michigan, the Ross Business School. We were reading papers written by W. Chan Kim and Renee Morbon, and they particularly were the ones that commanded our attention. We felt they were looking at innovation through a different lens, and we felt we needed to set up a ROR subcommittee, research on research subcommittee, to take a look at this more in depth. And so in 1999, there was one of these set up, and it was called Value Creation Through Value Innovation. And at our peak, we had something like 40 member companies who were looking into this in great detail. And it was that 2-3 year experience that got me going down the track of value innovation. I think we've refined it considerably. I think we've value innovated in the value innovation space. And we've taken the work of W. Chan Kim and Renee Morbon particularly to the next level.
And to the next level through your experience of actually applying this?
Exactly, yes.
Great, thank you.
Yes, I'm an R&D guy at heart. I mean, I've run businesses, but when I was running those businesses, I paid special attention to the marketing side of the business and also the development of new products as well.
Great. So you gave us a history of how you came to seeing the value of the value innovation process. So do you want to give us a high-level but easy to understand explanation of what is value innovation?
Okay. It's a 10-step process, and by the way, I will share with you that companies who look at our value innovation process, by the way, we've applied for a trademark of that term with the USPTO, but some companies have modified it to make it work within their own processes. It's very difficult to go into a company that's been working in this space for a long time to get them to get rid of the processes and tools that they have in place now. So it's more a situation where you would go in and take the pieces of the value innovation process that you don't have and meld it into the system that you have in place now. But if you were starting from scratch, and small business owners can do that, it's a 10-step process. And that 10 steps, or the 10 steps are, number one, define exactly what it is we want to achieve. So project definition. Who's the champion? Who's the leader? What resources do we have? When will we start? When will we end? Who are the team members? What are the specific objectives? What's in scope? What's out of scope? All that good stuff up front. I'm amazed when we go into large companies, especially where they've been working on a project for 4 or 5 years, and the team members today are not the team members that started, and we ask them that question, what is it we're trying to do? We don't know the answer to that question. That's not good. Step number two, develop the value chain. So that what that does is identifies each buying, selling, and using transaction between you and the ultimate end user and identify the most important customer using a tool we call the three questions. Step number three, develop an as-is value curve. Now, for some of the folks out there who have read Blue Ocean Strategy, you'll remember that the first, half of the book is filled with strategy canvases. We call those value curves. We've taken them to the next level in as much as we rank order the elements of performance in the value curves, and we have a metric for each of those elements. So we develop an as-is value curve for the most important customer. Have we talked to the most important customer at this point? No. But what we do is put ourselves in the most important customer's shoes. Step number four, the most critical step in the whole 10-step process. It's contextual interviewing carried out in a unique way to uncover the unmet, unarticulated needs of those most important customers. The key of that step number four is that we carry out 6 interviews, 1 hour each, with 2 most important customers on each interview. Step number 5, now we know the unmet, unarticulated needs of those most important customers, we can develop a 2B value curve. In other words, what is it we're going to do to deliver this exceptional value to that most important customer? Steps 6 and 7 are to review that as-is and 2B value curves with the most important customer and have them critique those value curves without actually showing them those curves. Step number 8, we've got a vetted value curve now as a result of those interviews with the most important customers. Step 6 and 7, by the way, is the second interview that we carried out with those 6 pairs. Step number 8 is to define the value proposition, literally put the value curve in words. Step 9, now look at our options on how we can deliver the what. And then number 10, we go back for our third and final round of interviews with the most important customer, step 10, and have them critique the how. All this takes about 10 to 12 weeks to do. Nobody goes into a laboratory to add chemical A or chemical B. No software teams start developing software. Nobody does anything until we've completed those 10 steps. And those 10 steps are basically now sharing with us what we have to do and our options on how we can deliver exceptional value to that most important customer. See, that was a long-winded response to your question.
And it answers a lot of questions I had, because I always want to distill information down into bullet points that I can run with. And what you answered a question that I hadn't asked yet is there's not 3 questions, generic questions across the board. None of these steps, except for the steps themselves, are generic. They're all customized and they're all contextual to the organization, the company you're dealing with.
I'm sorry, it's totally customizable. So it works for any company of any size, regardless of the markets that they serve.
It works for any company, but prior to being able to implement this process, you have to have a lot of trust and have gained the opportunity to go deep into these companies to get this kind of information from them and to get access to determine who their important customers are. Because I would suspect that the companies don't already know who the most important customers are. They think salespeople would probably give you a different answer than the product people or the developers on who they think the most important customer is.
Most companies in the world of B2B, Cindy, think that their most important customers are their direct customers, and they are totally wrong in that conclusion.
So they think that their most important customer are the customer that generates the most revenue? Is that what you said?
No. No, no. The people who buy their products and services, their direct customers.
The direct customers they think are the most important.
Correct.
Dick, to help us understand that well, could you give us just a quick example of a value chain and who would be the most important customer in that?
I'll give it a shot, although it's not going to be a software example. Is that going to be okay, Chad?
I will try to keep up.
So I just will, my background is in software, but the audience comes from cross industry, hardware, software, manufacturing, consumer, across the board. So go ahead.
Well, let's take an example that everybody will understand. We'll take the example of a company that makes automotive parts. So, for example, it might be a Denver-based company like Gates, who makes belt sent hoses that go on cars. And they have 3 businesses. They have an OE business where they sell belts to the manufacturers of automobiles and trucks. They have a belts business where they sell to the OEs that make cars and trucks. Those businesses are capitally intense. The margins are generally very low. But in order to participate in the replacement part business, you have to have sold the products at the OE level. The replacement parts business is totally different from the OE business in as much as the margins are much, much higher. The value chain for automotive replacement parts is as follows. The manufacturer, let's take its gates, sells to distributors. There could be NAPA, CarQuest. There are not many major distributors in the United States. Those distributors sell to jobbers. Jobbers are typically small companies. They might even be retail stores like a parts store. In a town of 40,000 or so, there might be four or five jobbers. The jobbers distribute or sell the product to the auto dealers and repair shops in their town. And when your car ultimately breaks down, you, the consumer, buy that part from the auto dealer or the repair shop. They bill you for it. So the value chain looks very elementally as follows. Automotive replacement parts manufacturer sells to the distributor, sells to the jobber, sells to the auto dealer and repair shop, sells to the consumer. Who is the most important customer in the value chain? This is where we use the three questions. First question is, if there's a problem with your product, service, or offering, who's responsible for fixing that problem? Second question, if there's a problem with your product, service, or offering, who stands to lose the most financially? And the third, who sees the value? And when you use those three questions against the distributor, the jobber, the auto dealer or repair shop, and the consumer, you conclude the most important customer is, and I know Chad knows the answer, so I'm going to put it over to Chad. Chad, who is the most important customer in that value chain?
Okay, so let me review real quick. So we got manufacturers selling to distributors, sell to jobbers who actually take the parts to repair shops to fix the car for the consumer. And
yes.
You said if I'm the manufacturer, I may suspect that my most important customer is the distributor because I just sell directly to them, but that would be wrong, right?
Correct.
Because even though they're the ones that give me the revenue, by your three questions, it sounds like the person that really would experience the pain if the part is wrong would be the repair shop?
Correct. So if the manufacturer of these parts focuses entirely on the distributor, they are not delivering exceptional value to the most important customer, which is the repair shop or automobile dealership.
So Dick, I think this is a pretty important point to camp on for just a moment. Because when I've been involved in startup organizations, figuring out this most important customer, most important person, has not been trivial. And we've made some big errors before.
Yes.
Is this a – you kind of alluded before, you see this often the issue with B2Bs. Just talk more about how many times you see people not getting this right.
Chad, it's literally every time. Can I give you another example of a Denver company? In fact, they're in the book. In fact, they're on page one, and we talk about Brad Fenn. Brad is been in the venture capital business, equity investment. He was asked in 2009 to come in and take a look at a company called Folded Pack. And they had a product, still have a product called Expandos. Expandos is a cardboard replacement for peanuts and bubble wrap so that it's used in packaging. The great thing about Expandos is, though, it is 100% recyclable, so it's green. The company was formed in 2004, and for the five-year period, 2004 to 2009, venture capitalists invested $7 million in this company. It had not fared at all well. And the VCs brought in Brad and said, we want you to take a look at this company. We have to make a decision on what we're going to do. We're either going to close it down, or we have to change fundamentally how we're doing business. Brad went in, looked at the value chain that they hadn't developed, but he developed it for them. They had assumed that their most important customer was the distributor. That's who they were selling to. And he said, I think we're talking about the wrong thing here. The most important customer is, in fact, the manufacturer of fragile, high-value-added products. Coors Tech, HP, Siemens, people who are shipping electronic components around the world. They changed their focus from the distribution to the manufacturers of those high-value-added fragile products, and the company has been completely turned around. It's quite amazing. So there's an example where, in fact, the VCs, the people running the business, had not done their homework looking at the value chain because they didn't even know that that's what they should be doing, did not realize that they, in fact, were not focused on the most important customer in the value chain.
Thank you for sharing the example, Dick. It helps to put the importance of understanding the value chain and that most important customer in good context.
Yeah, one of the key points, too, Chad, is that the most important customer might not buy the product, might not sell the product, but they use the product. And when you think about the world of software, it may well be users of that software who are supplied it by the company, for example, who are, in fact, the most important customers.
So if I could try and translate this for product managers, we're looking at who's using the product, but how would we even know who the users are if they didn't purchase it? We wouldn't have that data.
I didn't understand the question, Cindy. It sounded like a great question, but I didn't understand it.
I'm thinking in terms of how I access data about the market space, and I'll be looking at data of who's using my product. If they're not using my product, as you said, the most important customer may not even be a user. So I wouldn't know who that is merely by looking at the data I'm getting about how the features of the product are being used. I'm trying to translate this into software. So the only way I would know who the most important customer is by looking at the value chain, which
Correct.
Isn't obvious in usage data.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you to some degree here. And I would argue as follows, that if you are, let's say, developing some software for a specific application, you should be able to, if you're a top-flight product manager, be able to define the value chain. Okay, so we're the software company. What's the first thing that happens? Who do we sell our software to? Who is our direct customer? Might be a value-added reseller, for example. Who does the value-added reseller sell your product to? I don't know who that is, but that's the next step in the value chain. Let's throw in another degree of complication here. Let's assume that the most important customer is a large company, and I'm going to veer away from the software example because I'm not sure I fully understand it that well, but let's take an example like, mass merchant, Walmart. If we identify Walmart as the most important customer in our value chain, the next question is, who do we go to within Walmart to carry out these contextual interviews? We have 20, 30, 40, 50 departments we could go to. Which one should we be talking to? Who is the subject matter expert on our products or service? Is it purchasing? Never. Is it department merchandising? It may well be. So within the most important customer, we need to identify who within that customer is the most important customer. Has that made life yet more complicated, Cindy?
You know, it's something that ethnographers do, I think, in determining how to message about the product. It's something that product marketers do, but it's not an easy process that I think you could do without a level of expertise. I'm trying to figure out how to apply this tomorrow, Dick. When we get off the call.
I agree with you that this is a little, there's a new twist here, isn't there? I mean, we're asking product managers to ask questions or answer questions that they probably haven't addressed before.
Right. And when you said the three important questions that you asked, so I was ready to write down and to tweet out what those questions are until I realized they're totally contextual. I wouldn't know what the questions are to ask without going through the first five steps.
Now we've got all kinds of questions. The three questions are used to identify the most important customer in the value chain, and I shared with you what those were. Let's repeat them. The first one is, if there's a problem with our product, service, or offering, who's responsible for fixing it? The second is, if there's a problem with your product, service, or offering, who stands to lose the most financially? And the third is, who sees the value? And when we concluded it was the auto dealer or repair shop, who had to fix the problem? Well, you've driven your car into a repair shop in the middle of nowhere. They've ordered a replacement belt or a replacement hose. The wrong one comes in. You've now got extremely irritated because they haven't fixed your car, and you're living with the problem. Who stands to lose the most financially? The suppliers of replacement auto parts will, if it doesn't fit or it's the wrong SKU, will ship another one, another replacement part, and they won't charge you for it, but they will not compensate you for the labor that you've invested to find out that you haven't solved the problem. And then the third question, who sees the value? The owner of that repair shop or the auto dealership sees the value, because what I want to do is to fix your car as quickly and reasonably as possible. You probably, the consumer, don't care if you pay $10 for the belt, $50 a belt, or $100 for the belt. You want to just get out of there. And that's what the auto dealer wants to see you too, out back on the road and feeling happy and good about life.
So, Dick, I suspect, you know, when I've been in startup situations, we don't always have a clear understanding of what the value chain is or will end up looking like. And you talked about the step of identifying the value chain and the most important customer and then doing contextual interviewing somewhere in there.
Yes.
I would think it would make sense that you might uncover things during the contextual interviewing that makes you rethink your value chain. Does that happen?
Yes, and not only might you rethink the value chain, because you're going to say, well, I don't think these are most important customers, it may cause you to rethink the project. With step one, we said these are our objectives. After we've completed step four, which is to uncover the unmet, unarticulated needs of those most important customers, we may conclude that the project, as we originally conceived it, is way off base, and there is no point in continuing. We might as well shut it down right now. What might well happen is, in fact,
it starts a very new project
as a result of that.
Right. You know, because why would you want to waste all that energy going down a path that's not going to end up being a profitable product?
Well, exactly. And that's, unfortunately, as you know, Chad, most entrepreneurs don't do that. They've got this great idea, and they just keep on going.
Well, because tech innovators, they want to build stuff. They'll find what the problem that they're solving is after they built it.
I'm going to change the word innovator to entrepreneur,
okay,
Cindy. Entrepreneurs have this passion and drive for their wonderful idea, and it's great that they've got that, but they need to put that idea into the hopper and go through this 10-step value innovation process. They can complete it in 10 to 12 weeks. We can save an awful lot of money and time if we use that process. As you know, most entrepreneurial startups are not successful.
So, Dick, let me ask you. I suspect there's an entrepreneur out there listening now or listening to the archive that's going to say, wow, 10 to 12 weeks, I don't have that kind of time. I got to get my product out to the market. What would you say about that?
I would say you make the time. And I would also probably press back on, you really think they'll have it done in 10 to 12 weeks? I doubt it. 10 to 12 weeks for a startup, I don't think is very much time.
And what are the consequences of being wrong?
The consequences of being wrong with what? The idea?
Yeah, with going down the path that you haven't really fleshed out.
Far better to find out that you're going down the wrong track within 10 to 12 weeks and go on for the next 1 to 2 years and find out then
that
you've been going down the wrong track.
So what you're proposing is that this value innovation process enables you to almost guarantee the success of a product if you do due diligence up front, as opposed to...
Correct.
As opposed to throwing spaghetti against the wall and seeing if it sticks and then iterating from there, you're almost advocating what Chris Yeh here says, find the market before you start building. So what the value innovation process enables you to do is determine who that most important customer is, what the value chain is, before you invest in building and millions of dollars and building out your team for a product that won't be successful.
You're exactly right, Cindy. Where this value innovation process sits is at the front end of innovation. It takes a company committing to going into the agile process to develop the software until they've completed the value innovation process.
Excuse me, Dick. You mentioned... agile. So,
yes,
and you cut out for a little bit. So this is a important issue. Could you repeat everything you just said, please?
Yes. So the value innovation process goes on to the front end of your stage gate process or your agile process. The value innovation process takes to complete all the fuzziness out of the front end. What you have in hand, this is what we have to do, and these are our options on how we do it. At that point now, that project, if it's looking good, remember you've done 3 rounds of interviews now with most important customers. If it's looking good, they're saying, hey, thumbs up, when do I get this? Now you put it into your stage gate process or your agile process.
So that helps
did to
answer
help,
one Cindy? Of our...
Did I cut in or out there?
No, we got that. I'm just ruminating on what you said.
And that helps to answer
now,
one of
wait
our
a second.
Questions.
Is rumination good? Does that sound like a new vegetable?
It's a good thing. It means that...
It is a good thing. Just imagine. We have rutabagas and... yeah, okay.
I must say, it's been difficult to tweet because you're going so deep into these issues. I can't get them into a 140-character headline here.
Well, now we're starting to, you know, maybe we need to go back and reinvent Twitter, you think?
That's a whole other discussion, Dick,
to
talk about communication tools and how to enable huge groups of people to communicate in real time. Is also a passionate interest of mine. But let's going back to the prepared questions, and we've been answering them all, so thanks, Chad, for keeping us on course. So question six was, where does value innovation work well? So I guess the assumption here is, are there specific industries or specific products where it works better than others?
No.
Okay. So it works well across the board. It could be applied in any business of whose intention is to generate revenue with new product innovation.
Yes, we have, Cindy, we've worked obviously for a number of companies doing a number of different things here. I don't know what this guy's doing. Doesn't matter what the size of the company is. Could be a company with 10 to 20 employees. It could be a large company, Procter & Gamble. Doesn't matter what the size is. Doesn't matter what markets are that they serve. It works. It could be a not-for-profit. It could be a government agency. We're looking at right now working with the Denver Office of Economic Development to help small businesses. So federal agencies, state agencies, local agencies can use this tool. They've all got customers. That's the common denominator for value innovation. If you have a customer, you can use this process.
Dick, you said this fits into the fuzzy front end of innovation, or as I like to call it, the
well, I don't know about fits
end.
Into the fuzzy front end. It what it does is take the fuzziness out of the front end.
And so, indeed, is that the 10-step process is then responsible for uncovering what that idea is and bringing it to a concept that we now know how to develop. That
right.
Yes. What you mean? Okay.
Yeah.
Excuse me, Chad and Dick, we have a caller on the line that wants to ask a question. Let's see if we can bring them in. Go ahead. Do you have a question?
Hello. Yes, I'm Mike from Albany, New York, and we happen to use Value Innovations. And the hostess, I think, Cindy, you asked a question about how difficult this is. Dick Lee's concept isn't difficult to administer. The issue is the customer has difficulty in finding the particular answers.
Ah.
We use it both in startups and regular businesses, and it's a tool that we think will enhance our economic development.
Excellent. Thank you, Mike. Did Chad pay you to, did Dick pay you to call in?
No, I received an email indicating he was going to be on this show, and I've sent it out to several hundred people here in upstate New York to have them listen.
That is excellent. Thank you so much.
Cindy,
yes, go
Cindy,
ahead.
Cindy, let's find out a little bit more about this mystery guest. I know Mike Franchel, and Mike, I know you have a virtual incubator in upstate New York that you are passionate about bringing upstate New York back into the real play of economic growth. You have a goal of driving 5% GDP growth for your area, and you have a virtual incubator with how many companies in it now?
Well, we have 25 startups in one sort of phase or another, but there are five or six that have gone live. We have a worth
wow,
of,
that's fantastic.
If they make it through all the steps, it will be $1 to $2 billion a year, and one company can penetrate a $40 billion a year market.
Impressive.
Well, Mike, it's great to have you call in here. And I know that you've become a student of the value innovation process and are requiring that all your companies use the process.
Well, I would like to share a story with you where I was talking last week with a couple of economic development people, and their goal was they were going to offer free rent on Main Street. We couldn't get by the free rent because I kept asking them, I said, who is the most important customer? That question is very, very hard for economic development people to figure out when you're looking at Main Street. But it's a simple question to ask, but an important one to answer.
Yes. Well, Michael, it's great to have you on the show calling in here today.
Well, we have a couple of venture capitalists listening to you, so I hope that'll help us.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you, Michael. By the way, email me, Cindy at PRODMGMTTALK, so I can get your contact information and include you in the transcripts of the show.
You know, what a great call to just point out how practical this is. And I think, Dick, you've created something here that explains it well. I'm curious more about this fuzzy front end notion, right? Because, as I know, you have also been interested in the annual Global 1000 Innovation Report. This year, that report showed that I think it was like 25% of the 1,000 companies involved said they were satisfied with their fuzzy front-end work, meaning that 75% were not. It sounds like, you know, this is a process that apparently in Upper State New York is making a big difference. And do you see this as something that can really help those companies make a difference with their fuzzy front-end?
Absolutely. Yes, what amazes me, Chad, and you're well aware of this, there's the Front End of Innovation Conference, which used to be put on by PDMA, and now it's the International Institute of Research that puts it on. I think they'll be into their 10th or 12th year coming up. And it's, what, 4 days, 5 days, talking about the front end of innovation and the things that you can do to remove the fuzziness. I will share that I have never been to that conference, and nobody has ever invited me to come speak. But I'm just amazed that so many people flock to Boston for the front end of innovation process. All they need to do is to pick up a book called Value Innovation Works, and they'll have the keys to the kingdom.
Well, according to that Global 1000 report, it's clearly an issue. And I know
yes, it is.
AIPMM, which sponsors your talk, Cindy, their certified innovation leader credential, you know, half of that is focused on understanding more what is involved in the fuzzy front end, and that's a place that companies know they need help.
Yes, they do.
Desperately.
Absolutely no question. I mean, I spent, when I was in the world of R&D, I'm going to say, and Cindy shared this, probably 30 years of my life coming up with new products that were basically based on internally generated ideas. We would invest a lot of money in developing those things, and then we would go out once we got the product and see if there was a problem out there that we could solve. This is exactly the wrong way round. What entrepreneurs need to do is to quantify the problems that they think they can address and solve. That's what they should be developing their ideas around, those problem solutions.
Very good. I think we've made it through many of our formal questions here. I was curious about looping back around, if I may, on your steps. Because it seems to me those early steps in your process are the really critical ones to get grounded in the value chain, the most important customer, and then this contextual interviewing. Can you talk more about what contextual interviewing looks like? You mentioned 6 interviews and pairs. What does this look like?
Okay. Yes, we carry out 6 one-hour interviews in step 4. And why 6? Well, our experience, and we've been doing these things around the world for quite some time, our experience with 6 is that after you've heard 3 and 4 pairs, when you get to number 5 or number 6, you don't hear anything new. So that's why 6. Why pairs? Obviously, by the way, one of the criticisms that we get when we hear, but you're interviewing 2 most important customers at the same time, you're poisoning the well. Well, I must admit, I felt that that's what we would be doing also, but what I can share is that these pairs that we interview don't get to hear what the others said. And so the poisoning of the well doesn't appear to occur. And what does happen is when somebody makes a comment or a statement in answer to the question, what keeps you awake at night, that triggers another thought in the mind of the second person on the interview. So it moves, it takes it away from being a question and an answer, a question and answer with one most important customer on the hot seat all the time. It moves from that to being an in-depth discussion.
So before Cindy had asked about, she mentioned ethnographic research.
Yeah.
Does something like that fit into this also, or is it separate?
I think it's separate. Ethnography to me is the whole area of observation. And what we're trying to do with our most important customers is talk to experts in the field, and what they're going to do when they answer questions is going to give you the answer based on their experience of seeing hundreds of these things as opposed to just one. So if I'm a Procter & Gamble, for example, and I'm watching this consumer shop for toilet paper in a supermarket, yes, I'll be able to see in one event what happens in that one situation. Would I turn the world upside down based on that observation? Absolutely not.
Okay, great. Thank you for addressing that.
Thank you, Dick, and thank you, Chad. We've come to the end of the hour so quick, and I feel like, as I do weekly, we've just started this conversation. So I invite you to come back and let's talk about it some more. When we go offline, I will tweet out the winner for the book, Value Innovation Works. Visit Dick's website at valueinnovations.com, where you can find the book and more information about this process. Chad, thanks for joining us. Chad, could you give us a little bit more? You mentioned the Certified Innovation Leader Training and that you actually give a course in training people to be innovation leaders in their organization. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. The Association of International Product Marketers and Managers, they already provide certifications for product management and brand management, and they were looking to add really the innovation piece to that with an emphasis on the managed front end, people call it fuzzy front end. So I was one of the people who helped out with that effort, and indeed now AIPMM is offering that certification, and we will be starting workshops, and I think there's a workshop actually that they're doing this month, and there'll be online study groups starting in January. And I should know this, but I suspect we can find out more if we go to AIPMM.com, and it will talk about the Certified Innovation Leader Program.
You bet. And thank you again to the AIPMM for sponsoring this broadcast and weekly broadcasts. Join us in 2 weeks when we will be live with Joanna Rothman discussing project portfolio management and all that entails. Also, join the AIPMM webinar series on Fridays. The next one will be Friday, November 30th, the Framework Fight Club with Sean Campbell, where we'll be discussing different frameworks for analyzing your competitors. And looks like that's very exciting, all of the tools that we'll be discussing in that webinar, which is a presentation, and I'm delighted to be moderating those webinars. Subscribe to the AIPMM newsletter to find out about not only the Global Product Management Talk, but upcoming events and new articles, AIPMM.com/subscribe. Next week on the Global Product Management Talk, listen to an interview that I did a while ago with Dudata.com, a startup that is deconstructing what retail purchasing, the experience of it online. That was on Startup Talk Radio in our archives. And join us live again in 2 weeks on Monday. Follow us at blogtalkradio.com/prodmgmttalk. Dick, would you like to give us a closing remark?
Cindy, it was great to be on the show today. Just a plug for the book, Value Innovation Works. You can order it from Amazon.com. That's Value Innovation Works. You can buy it in the paperback version or the Kindle version. If you want to take a look at some of the excerpts from the book, if you go to our website, www.valueinnovations.com, you'll see that there is a button there, Value Innovation Works. and you can download some PDF files. Our first Mastering Value Innovation Workshop in 2013 will be held at the end of January, and the brochures for our three different workshops that we do, Mastering Value Innovation, Mastering Contextual Interviewing, and Delivering the How, will also be on our website within the next couple of weeks. But Cindy, it was great to be on the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you to our listeners, our audience. Thank you to the live callers, the tweeters. A lot to be thankful for in this week of gratitude. And please tweet us, follow us, and definitely follow us at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. If this was interesting to you, let us know. Blog about it and continue the conversation offline. Have a great week. Our intro theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com and the great Mark Blasco. We are broadcasting live from studio132.com.
Thank you for using Blog Talk Radio. Goodbye.